Podcast with myself, Cash, and my co-host, Beth. We talk to food and drink entrepreneurs about their businesses, how they got started, the journey so far, and what gets them out of bed in the morning.
For this episode, we spoke to Joel, one of the co-founders of The Good Egg. The Good Egg has two sites in London, and its food is inspired by Jewish and Middle Eastern flavours, and in generally the menu and the restaurants themselves are inspired by the brunch scenes in LA, Melbourne, Sydney, and taking ideas also from Jewish delis in New York.
It was really interesting speaking to Joel about the two sites and the differences between them, the challenges of the first site initially and how those were overcome and how they found their feet and really became such a success very quickly. And then taking that into a new site in Soho, which provided new challenges, was much bigger and had a different clientele. Mm. It was interesting to hear how they faced those differences and how the two sites are now developing their own individual identities.
Yeah, it's a really good episode, so hope you enjoy. Hi, Joel.
Hi.
Welcome. It is so good to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What was your first ever job?
My first ever job was washing up in the pub at the end of my road in Hertfordshire. And yeah, washing up, aged about 13 or 14, doing the dishes without a dishwasher in like the busiest pub in the area.
Yeah.
It wasn't very much fun.
No, not well paid. And
very badly paid. But yeah, I wanted to have my own money. Mm. And that was it. So I think I did every Friday night for that, you know, for a period of time. And washed the dishes and chopped the cabbage. And I just remember being desperate to use, they had a glass washer but not a dishwasher. So at the end of the night, I'd like save up all the cutlery and go and put it through that to try and speed. And it was never quicker because you had to do it so many times. Anyway, yeah. So that was my first experience of my first job and my first sort of kitchen experience.
And how did you find kind of being in the kitchen environment at that stage? Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, I loved it. It was a very like laddie pub kitchen full of, you know, not particularly good chefs that were, but it was a lot of fun and I loved being around food, and I kind of liked that atmosphere and being in, you know, working the sort of late nights and things like that. It kind of got me thinking that that was something I might want to do.
And then what was your first foray into food?
I guess that sort of developed into work. Mm. So I worked in a few different pubs in the area, and as I got older and more able to do, well, yeah, they trusted me more to do things. So I went and worked at a couple of other pubs which ranged from like, you know, sort of gastro pub where everything was cooked from scratch, and I learned a huge amount, probably the most there at that one, to places where everything was deep fried or in a microwave, you know, those sort of, I know this is just all, you know, all weekends or evenings or summer jobs. But yeah, that was that kind of my first, I get apart from at home cooking, you know, with family and things like that, that was my first kind of introduction to kitchens and cooking on a bigger scale.
Cool. And where did the idea for The Good Egg start?
It's quite a long-winded thing. So I was basically doing like a silly diet to try and lose weight, which is one called like the slow carb diet, which is like I don't know if you guys know Tim Ferriss. He's a sort of American lifestyle writer and podcaster and things like that. Anyway, so it was like a high protein diet, and you couldn't get this, you know, you couldn't get that in London at the time. They didn't have the egg pots in Lyon and things like that. So the first iteration of The Good Egg was like a sort of street food stall or kiosk in like Soho, where I was working at the time in an office, that did like this sort of, you know, high protein, healthy things, which then turned into The Good Egg being like a brunch sort of pop-up. We're doing different brunches from around the world, and then I met my business partners, Alex and Oded. Oded was from Israel, and my dad's side of the family are Jewish. So we were doing shakshuka at the time, and so it was a sort of slow evolution from, you know, this rubbish diet thing to eggs to brunch and then to this sort of all-day neighbourhood, Tel Aviv, New York, Jewish-inspired restaurant.
And so you had a pop-up before you had the restaurant as it is now?
Yeah, so we started doing market stalls 6 years ago, so the end of 2012. We did our first market stalls with Feast and Street Feast and Curb and people like that. whilst we were still sort of refining the concept. And then that turned into a few sort of pop-ups and residencies. So we did one called the Hangover Club on a rooftop in London Bridge, which was really great. And that was every weekend. And then we took over the Citroen Garage for a summer, which is now the Meat Liquor just off Upper Street. And a few other bits and bobs, mostly like sort of, you know, taking someone else's space when they weren't using it and doing our brunches there.
Did you always have the restaurant in mind as sort of the end goal?
Yeah, I think I'd had that. I kind of made the decision when I had a job, an office job in IT that I left to do something, to do food and that. So I kind of had it in my mind that I wanted to have my own food business, and I had been thinking of doing a restaurant for a while. But it just took a couple of years to kind of hone what that concept was going to be.
And what was the restaurant space or the pop-up space looking like? Because that sounds like you're kind of ahead of... You're definitely ahead of the curve with the protein stuff. 2012
seems quite early. If we'd done the egg pots, we'd have beaten Leon to it.
Yeah, you would have.
I don't know. So we worked with a really fantastic food business incubator called Kitchenette. And we went through a process with them to refine the concept and I guess it was looking. We were looking for something that, you know, that utilized our experiences and our kind of heritage, and would make something with a bit more longevity than, you know, what was perhaps like something, you know, faddy or diet. You know, and what we've come out with is much more about us, about the founders, and much more about the food that we grew up with, and much more, I think, what people want than, I don't know, not sure it was very me doing a thing that was based on like high protein breakfast and things like that. You know, we wanted something that was much more fun, much more honest, much more like the food that you eat at home. So that kind of, I guess it was a natural evolution that got, and we came out in a really good place.
And did you find when you started, because the kind of flavours you use and the sort of, you know, the Israeli ingredients and condiments and the Middle Eastern flavours weren't so present then? Really, were they?
I guess a few people were doing them.
A few people
were doing them. But I feel like it's huge now.
It's huge now, and I just wondered what the reception was like when you first started, whether people found it sort of... Because I imagine then it was quite new and exciting for your customers.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, we were... You know, Ottolenghi had been doing his thing for a long time, and so Oded, one of my business partners, was a pastry chef at Ottolenghi after he trained in Tel Aviv, and... So, you know, we were familiar with all of those flavours. I guess the thing that we did differently was that we combined that with kind of the sunny Californian brunch, that, you know, sort of taking a traditional Jewish deli out of that context of New York and kind of not particularly well-sourced ingredients and that sort of thing, and putting it somewhere where sourcing was the most important thing, like, you know, and as if it was in Tel Aviv or in California or Melbourne or somewhere like that, drop it into East London, and then... I guess the thing that everyone got on board with was brunch, and people loved that. You know, people hadn't really had shakshuka before, or the sabig, which is the aubergine pita that we do.
That's my favourite, by the way. I think that might be my favourite dish.
I've eaten too many of them in the last few years. So but, and the root, you know, not long after we started curing our own brisket for pastrami and short ribs for pastrami. So we do our own version of a Reuben. So I guess we were making some of those things that were a bit exotic and a bit foreign, a bit more accessible, and doing them in our own way, and presenting them in brunch really took off. I don't want to say that we were like ahead of the curve for brunch, but it's still not as big in the UK as it is in Melbourne or in like Hong Kong, or, you know, there's people still don't go for brunch as much as, you know, it's not such a cultural thing. It's getting there here, but that really, I guess that's what put us on the map in Stone Newington and got us known, is that, you know, that we were the place with brunch queues around the corner that did shakshuka and did all these, you know, kind of weird and wonderful things that worked as like a sort of sharing table. And then that brought people in for our evening offer, which isn't dissimilar, but it's, you know, there's no eggs, and it's very much, you know, sharing plates inspired by Tel Aviv and the sort of, you know, Jewish delis of New York and Montreal. So it kind of, I guess, yeah, one thing led to the other, but I think we introduced some of those flavours to people. You know, lots of people had had them before. You know, we have lots of customers that love Ottolenghi and love Honey and Co. and that whole sort of diaspora from the great work that he's done. But perhaps, you know, serving them for brunch with shakshuka, you know, we made a big thing of it, and that's what I think people got on board with.
I'm really hungry thinking about your food.
Shakshuka in Israel is such a, you know, it's not a it's not a peasant dish, but you know, it's made with leftovers and that sort of thing. I've always found it, even on like the Ottolenghi menu, it's there, but it's only there for breakfast, and most people go for something else, whereas for us it was, you know, this is what we do, you have to try this, you know, at least one person on the table has to get this, otherwise you haven't done it properly.
When did you open your Stokey restaurant?
So Stokey opened in November 2015.
Okay.
So just over 3 years ago.
And how did you go about finding a permanent space to be?
So we were looking. We decided to finish our pop-ups and focus on finding a site, because we were spending all of the week looking. We were catering for like Twitter's offices on a Tuesday. I was still working 3 days a week, and then doing, you know, it was kind of hard to slot all these things in. So we stopped and we started looking pretty much full time for a site, and we looked everywhere. And then I was just passing this, what used to be Ladbrokes on Stoke Newington Church Street, and it had a big Hackney Council sign on it saying property available.
That was Ladbrokes.
Mm.
It's such a good spot there.
Yeah,
wasted on a betting shop.
Yeah, I mean, I still have this sort of quiet plan to take over all of the betting shops in Hackney. But there was a big move. So we were good friends we had good connections with the regeneration department at Hackney Council, which was run by a guy called Andrew Sissons at the time. We'd done like some work with him on some other things, and so yeah, we sort of began the process of applying for that site through Hackney, and that was a really long, drawn out process. It wasn't a restaurant site at the time; it was A2, which is like betting shops and banks and things like that. So we had to get planning permission, and there was lots of opposition, mostly from the people that were living above, because obviously, you know, whilst a betting shop's not ideal, there was they didn't want a restaurant there with noise and smell and things like that. So we went through a year. We got that offer accepted in August 2014. We didn't actually get on site until August 2015 to start working on it. And then it took us till the November to be ready to open it.
Were they keen to get a small, like, independent in there?
It was a battle. So Regeneration were really keen for us to go in there. We were going to bring, compared to a shop or another something else, you know, we were going to bring lots of jobs.
Yeah.
We were going to offer training. And we actually, you know, in order to get the site, we had to write those criteria into our lease. And we've exceeded all of those, you know, hugely because we've made so many jobs and employed local people, and we work with Hackney on their Hackney 100 scheme, which is giving like work experience, or it's like paid work experience to young people in Hackney.
That's cool.
You do 4 hours a week, so we had two of them come this year to do that. And there's Ways Into Work as well, which is another sort of, you know, employment platform that Hackney promote. So yeah, Regeneration were there. We had a lot of support from the local area, as well as a few people that didn't want us there. So it was a long process working with planning listed building, because that area is a conservation area as well, and the property's listed. So that was fun trying to get through that process. Yeah, so it was sort of we had people helping us and people fighting us, and we got there in the end. It was quite a tough year.
Yeah, it's a long time, isn't it, to be kept waiting?
Yeah, but we knew from the moment we saw it, it's sort of perfect for a restaurant, because it's kind of slightly elevated.
Yeah.
It's got those big windows at the front. It's tons of natural light. It's a bit small for us now. We kind of, you know, we need some more space. But it's been for our first site, it's been amazing.
And then, so once that offer got accepted, where did you go from there? Like a designer, what architect, what? How do you do
it? So we worked almost exclusively with a friend of ours who was a furniture designer, a guy called, fantastic, really talented guy called Tom Graham, who was a friend of a friend. He got an architect friend of his that he'd studied with. So between them, so Stuart, who was the architect, and Tom, who was the furniture designer, and then Tom kind of project managed the whole thing. And so all of that beautiful furniture was all handmade, and the whole kind of, and so essentially we did it ourselves. So Tom and I were on site every day, you know, it was lots of like friends coming to help out and bits and bobs like that. We had, you know, we got someone in to do the kitchen, but it was a very sort of homemade project and very bespoke to us, and that's why. So we've tried to recreate that in our second site, and I think it's funny, I go in there and I can see lots of the same things, but other people walk in and they think, wow, this is so different. And it is very different.
It looks very different to me.
But if you kind of look closely, there's a lot of there's a lot of touches that link the two. But I think there's only me that sees them. me and the architect.
Nods to the original.
Yeah.
I think it comes across. I think you can... It feels bespoke. It feels like you've created an atmosphere there that very much suits the brunch vibe and kind of the inspiration you've taken from California and Tel Aviv. And
it's just really, it's really well designed. And, you know, yeah, it feels relaxed in there. And you've got the kitchen. I love that you can watch the chefs from the bar.
Yeah, they don't like that.
Do they not?
I think we've never ever had.
It's so hard to work in like a fairly small.
It's really small
space.
Yeah, it's a really challenging kitchen to work in.
Yeah.
It's good that I'm not in the kitchen as much anymore because I'm always very ambitious with what I like. You know, like I have more things on the menu. And the chefs don't know this, but so they've got a really good Alex who's. The third founder, my business partner, is the head chef in Stone Newington.
Okay.
And they've got a very good like balance of what they do now. And they, you know, we used to have the kitchen split across both sides.
Mm.
And now one half's just pastry, and the other half's like, you know, all the cooking. So even though it's a smaller area to work in, they're very organised and focused. But yeah, it's a lovely site, and I think people love that. You know, they can come in for brunch and sit on the bar and watch everyone working. But there's nowhere to hide there. And the same in Soho now. We've managed to get two restaurants with almost no back of house area. There's nowhere where you can hide and cut potatoes out of the watching eyes of customers. Everything has to be done in front of the customers.
But then that kind of reflects your brand as well, that it's transparent and you care about sourcing and, you know, you're not dragging out, popping something in the microwave.
Like yeah, that's it. There's no, like, you know, there's no vacuum bags coming in,
yeah.
in, you know, being put in a water bath. I mean, there is a bit of that, but... For good reasons.
Yeah.
There's nothing sort of, yeah, there's nowhere to hide and we don't want to, so that's yeah. It works.
So once you'd opened after all the amazing processes up until that point, how did you find the first couple of months? How did it differ from running kind of the pop-ups and market stores?
It was really tough and we were all doing loads of hours at that time. So, you know, we hadn't figured anything out by that point. So we had contracts for our staff, but everyone was doing, you know, doing 50, 60 hours a week. And everyone was getting exhausted. And we opened right before Christmas and it was really busy. And we, you know, there's just all those things that you can kind of, we didn't plan that well before we opened because we were so busy building the site ourselves and trying to figure out what was on the menu. And then you open and everything changes. And we had a burger on the menu at the start with pastrami in it. And this massive omelette called a Californian omelette, which was a sort of ode to the Zuni Cafe in San Francisco and Berkeley. It's just all this mad stuff that we used to do we're like, why did we do that at the time? You know, why did we take a big pan out to get an omelette? Anyway, it was a really delicious omelette, but it was just bonkers that was on the menu and you were cooking something to order. Anyway, yeah, so we figured a lot of stuff out really quickly and staffing and, you know, people left and people came and people changed job roles and stuff. So it was really tough. And we kind of took stock of everything in April and realised we weren't making any money and then had to change the way we were thinking about that and how many hours we were giving to pastry because we make all our own, you know, make all our babkas and burekas and pastries and things in-house. So, yeah, it was a really steep learning curve made a lot easier by the fact that we were busy. And that was, you know, so kind of customers and sales solves everything. So it was a nice problem to have that we were, you know, especially... You know, Thursday to Sunday night and Saturday and Sunday brunch was just, you know, we were always full. And that was really lovely. So we were, you know, very sort of thankful that we were accepted by Stone Newington and kind of, you know, it was a really, we made, you know, had a really good start to life there. And we were busier than we thought we'd be from day one. And you know, touch wood, that hasn't stopped yet. Yeah, that kind of made it easier. We could change things gradually, but it was tough. And it's tough doing that with, you know, I guess it was nice. There's three of us that kind of, you know, are owners of the business, you know. But ultimately, yeah, one of you's got to be there at 4 a.m. when like the fridge breaks or something like that. And there's no, you know, there's kind of no escaping how all-consuming hospitality is, especially at that early point when you haven't really figured anything out yet. You know, none of us had a background in hospitality. None of us had worked in restaurants before properly, so we were kind of learning everything on the job.
And at that point, did you have kind of roles set out for each of you, or were the three of you kind of all doing everything together?
No, we were. So Alex was chefing, Oded was pastry chefing, and I was officially the general manager, but then quite soon after opening ended up handing that over to Tom, who's still our general manager in Soho now, fantastic human being, and but ended up going back into the kitchen from about the December or January of that first year. But yeah, I mean, we just did everything. Everyone did everything, you know. So you try and like squeeze 20 minutes time on your laptop in before a shift, or you know, work through the night to get things done. But yeah, it was good. I mean, we're lucky because there's still five or six people that have been there since the beginning, and we found, you know, almost completely by chance. Like Tom was working at Tramshed in Shoreditch and wanted something close to his house. He lived in Stoke Newington. Juliet, who's now our group head chef, was working at Mission, which is now Sager and Wild. And just happened to get introduced to us by the guy that was doing our tea. You know, it was just all these random connections that are now, and they're people that, you know, they're still with us now, and still senior figures in the business that can kind of, you know, that means there's more of us that are there to promote the values and kind of keep some order to things. Because it's a mad industry. It's like, you know, there's always something going wrong. It's always some sort of chaos. There's always someone leaving or not showing up to work, or a supplier that won't deliver, or someone that's bill hasn't been paid or something. You know, it's never a dull moment.
Yeah, you're relying on so many outside entities to make
things
work.
So many people.
Yeah.
And people are unreliable. there's so many.
I was trying to say it in a nice
way. It's just so, I mean, but it is, but it's why you love it and why you hate it as well. But there's so many human factors, you know, you're relying on individuals to do everything. You're relying on your customers who are people, and you're, you know, there's a lot of places where things can go wrong. But you get, you know, we're slowly, now with two sites, you know, we've got most of our systems in place and things are much more stable than they were in those sort of early days of Stoke Newington, where everything was a bit mad.
Yeah, but you kind of have to go through that, I imagine, to figure out where you need the systems.
Yeah, that's true. Or we could have put them in place beforehand, but that's not our style.
How did you go about developing the menu and developing some of your signature dishes? Have you done a lot of travelling?
A little bit, not as much as I'd like to have done. But so yeah, we went to Tel Aviv, done quite a lot of travelling around, like California, and then New York more recently. But yeah, most of it came from, it all seems to come back to what we grew up eating, what we like cooking at home, and trying to keep to an ethos of that, you know, the kind of loose concept that Jewish food basically means anything, you know, because there's Jews that have gone to all, you know, different far reaches of the world. So, you know, the sabiq is an Iraqi Jewish sort of sandwich, aubergine sandwich from Tel Aviv, with a Yemenite Jewish sauce in it, and there's this weird, the amber, which is the mango pickle, is like an Iraqi Indian Jewish sort of hybrid of all these things, and it's quite hard to find it. There's a really similar, you know, you can buy similar things from Indian grocers as you can. So there's just all these mad things, and there's obviously there's a huge Middle Eastern population in Australia that's kind of part of that whole brunch scene in Melbourne, and it's just a huge, like, wide ranging thing. And that coupled with our sort of attitude to sourcing and, you know, trying to keep things seasonal, using what's available. We work really closely with our fruit and veg and our fish supplier and our meat supplier to kind of, you know, keep with the seasons, keep with what's plentiful. I guess that, you know, that's what kind of how it's evolved. And then Juliet, who I mentioned, is our group head chef now. She came on board as a sous chef, and before we'd even opened, we promoted her to head chef because we didn't have another head chef. And she grew up in, her parents run a fishmonger's in Cockfosters, which is a very, she's not, her family aren't Jewish, but it's a very Jewish area. So she grew up with all of these things that I'd kind of grown up with, but not as closely. So, you know, with the smoked salmon and the gefilte fish and all these things that are really, you know, deep-rooted in kind of the Ashkenazi Jewish culture and cuisine. She'd been making since she was like, you know, since she was tiny. So she came in as our head chef and had this amazing other take on it. And she'd been working at Mission, so she kind of had that lovely seasonal kind of approach to using veg and things like that. So she crafted a lot of it as well, especially on our dinner menu. Mm. So some of our best loved dishes now are dishes that she brought in or that we developed together. But yeah, generally it's just like, what's good? Do we like it? We made our za'atar fried chicken. That was, you know, we wanted to put a fried chicken dish on the menu. Mm. God knows why. And that's been our best-selling dish for dinner forever because it's accessible to people, and it's kind of, it's not particularly Middle Eastern. It's just fried chicken with za'atar in the thing. And it's, yeah, and that's, you know, that was a recipe that came via, you know, other places and things. But it all kind of, I guess as long as it's all being tied together by some of those things, then it kind of works. And we kind of, we try to get as open as we can when we're developing things. You know, we get trying to get as much, as many of the team involved as we can and make it, whilst, you know, not changing things so regularly that it hinders what you're doing and makes things confusing. Trying to, you know, always be moving and always be thinking.
Do you source many of your ingredients from Israel?
No, almost. Do we? Yeah, so we use a kosher food supplier for the amber, and our tahini comes from Israel now as well. But then, so we work with some suppliers that, you know, so our za'atar is Jordanian. I think, I can't remember where our sumac comes from. But yeah, so we use that, but we don't import a lot of stuff. That's kind of, it's only those really specialist ingredients that come from sort of, you know, actually the Middle East. Everything, we try and get as much as we can through Natura, our veg supplier, who are really fantastic, and try and just use things that haven't got too many air miles on them.
And how did you go about developing those relationships with your suppliers? Did you get on board with Natura straight away? And then what about meat and fish?
We did. So Natura we've worked with since the beginning. Jules had worked with them at a previous job. So we worked quite a lot with the SRA, with the Sustainable Restaurant Association, when we first started. And they've got their list of approved suppliers. And it was really important to us that we got our kind of rating with them. So we've got 3-star rating with them now, which is the highest you can get. And we do as much as we can, sort of, you know, they support us and we support them. So it's just, yeah, I guess we kind of, without being too formal about it, set ourselves some criteria that we wanted to work with, you know, with good suppliers who looked after their own staff and had good attitude towards their ingredients. So we started working with Swaledale, who we still work with, who's a meat supplier, whole animal butcher in Yorkshire, that first sort of, I think that spring that we first opened. It's just good. This just means there's more back and forth with them about, you know, if we ask for something, they say, well, why don't you try taking this instead? Or can you take a whole section of that so that it brings the price down and you can use this for something else? And their meat's all fantastic, you know, sort of rare breed, free range sort of stuff, which is, you know, it's kind of expected now, but there's a lot of butchers out there still selling not free range meat or chicken or whatever. And that's, you know, you have to kind of, you still need to do your, you can't just rely on everyone that's got a picture of a cow on their website selling you something good. You have to, you know, it's really important to us that we've got a good relationship with those suppliers.
It's the same with eggs as well. I'm always surprised when I see eggs that aren't free range, because mostly it is free range now in the supermarkets, but in some of the bigger ones you'll get non-free, and I'm just always surprised to see them there.
Yeah, and it's really hard to, you know, sometimes it's not that straightforward to tell.
No,
you know,
there's a
picture of a very happy looking chicken on the front, and then it's like eggs from cage hens.
Yeah, really, like, small, you have to really look.
Yeah, no, it's the whole thing's a minefield. So one thing we have got with our fish supplier is a contract, and that was something the SRA suggested to put in place. So we work with South Bank Fish, who have a guy there, a fantastic guy called Matt Couchman, who's their fisheries scientist. And they're not allowed to send us anything that's not between 1 and 3 on the MSC, Marine Stewardship Council rating. So sometimes we'll order something and it just won't come. And that's because we've said to them, we don't, you know, if you can't get it in this particular way, or if it can't be fished sustainably, then we don't want it. And, you know, and then we'll have a chat with them about getting something else, which doesn't happen. They're also very good at, you know, keeping us up to date on what's coming in and what's available and what's not.
That's great.
But yeah, so that's the only actual contract we've got in place of that kind. But it's really important, because that's such a dangerous area where you can easily be getting something that's doing more harm than good by putting it on your menu.
It's so hard to keep on top of what is sustainable and what which fish, for example, we shouldn't be eating it.
Yeah, and your suppliers, you know, they're the ones that are closest to it. They should be telling everyone that. So,
yeah. It's great that you can get that information directly from them.
Yeah, I was just going to say that when you're doing it on a big scale, you really notice how much you're getting through. So you are going to be using up so much meat and fish and eggs. And when you're doing that quantity, you do want it to be... best.
And our customers, our customers want it, it's a big thing for us to make sure that the staff can talk about where the food comes from, because it is something that customers are, over the last few years, have become increasingly more aware of. You know, people are trying to eat better meat less often. So, you know, if they want to come and have, if, you know, we kind of know that lots of people, particularly in Stoke Newington, are coming, if they're coming to us once a week for dinner, which some people do, they, you know, if they're going to have their their meat there, they're going to have their lamb chops at our restaurant, they need to know that they're going to be, you know, well-sourced. Otherwise, they may as well go to the butcher opposite and get them and, you know, cook them at home.
So you opened Stokey in 2015, late 2015. And then recently, you've opened up in Kingly Court in Soho. I've heard the application process is quite different for Kingly Court. So how did you decide that you wanted to open up a second site, first of all? And then how was that process of securing the spot in Kingly Court, which is prime location, it's such a beautiful place to have a restaurant?
So we were sort of tentatively looking. We weren't really looking. I guess at the beginning of 2016 or something, no, beginning of 2017, so the kind of beginning of our like second year at Stoke Newington, things were a bit more stable. And we started looking around, and it's like everyone knows everyone in restaurants, so you get to know the people that are in restaurant property and that. So we got started getting sent things. We looked at this a site in this building, which is now Nula, downstairs, a couple of times. We just started looking, and then we kind of said to ourselves, actually, what we really need to do is like spend 6 months really like, you know, tweaking Stoke Newington, getting it, you know, give it not putting ourselves under so much pressure. And within like a week, someone from Shaftesbury or Shaftesbury's agent had got in touch with us asking if we wanted to have a look at Kingly Court. And we'd kind of been talking on and off with Shaftesbury, who are the landlord there, and they own the whole of Carnaby and Neil's Yard and lots of really lovely parts of sort of Soho and around Shaftesbury Avenue. So we went and had a look at it, they weren't offering it to us. We had to apply for it and, you know, sort of put a pitch together, and there was a lot of interest in the site. But because we'd had, I think because they liked what we did in Stoke Newington and they wanted an all-day offer, they wanted to have someone that could do the evening as well, but also bring something different to the mornings and breakfast and brunch, weekday and weekend. So I think they were really keen on us. We just had to demonstrate that we could do it and we could do something that big, and somehow we managed to convince them that we could, despite, you know, having never done a site that big.
How many covers is Stoke Newington compared to...
So Stoke Newington, so if people sit, including the bar, and some people don't like sitting in the bar, it's about 44.
Is it?
But yeah, so that's a real squeeze. So we're doing an event this weekend where we've sold tickets, which is our Chinese Jewish Christmas, which is going to be a lot of fun, and we've got 40 for that, and that's going to be kind of tight. But yeah, and then Soho is 120 including outside, so it's triple.
yeah
so it was mad, it was like completely bonkers. But you know, we it was really nice that Shaftesbury, you know, wanted us to consider it and wanted to consider us, and we spoke to other people around. So, you know, we've got lots of friends in the industry, we know the people at, you know, we know the Pizza Pilgrims guys very well, and the White and Brown guys opposite, and close friends at Brindisa, which is also in Soho. So, you know, we kind of did our research and talked to everyone, and, you know, everyone's general consensus was, you've got to go for it. So we did. And, it's been a really tough year. For, you know, it's a big step up going for, you know, we were very much big fish in a small pond in Stoke Newington without doing a disservice to any, you know, there's lots of other lovely restaurants there, but we've got that. That's kind of, you know, our turf. Mm. And then... yeah, you're going into a huge, huge pond in Soho and everyone's got so many options for breakfast, lunch and dinner. So yeah, so it's taken a year probably to adjust to that and to, you know, to figure out what we needed to keep the same from Stoke Newington and what we needed to do differently. But yeah, it's been a really, really great year. We've kind of, you know, we've got really taken a year to get a really fantastic, stable team in place there, who all seem very happy to be there. And get the offer right, and yeah. So we've every month been busier than the one before, and we're in the middle of mad December where it's just, you know, I'm trying to avoid going there because it's so busy and I don't want to get in the way. So yeah, it's been really good. And Shaftesbury were, you know, they very much the opposite of the kind of big scary landlord that people think. You know, I guess, you know, if you own that much property in central London, you are a big scary landlord. But they take a lot of care in who they put into their sites. So, you know, there's no real chains in Kingly Court. Everyone's, you know, the most anyone's got is, I think Pizza Pilgrims are the biggest chain in there, and they've got like 8 sites now, but they're still run by James and Tom, who are, you know, very nice guys.
That's what's so nice about that part of central London. It does feel
like they've done a really good job, you know. And I think we looked at a pop-up with Shaftesbury a few years ago in the upper levels of Kingly Court, and we were just like, no one's going to go up the stairs to go to our, you know, to our pop-up there. You know, we'll come talk to us when you've got a ground floor site. But the sites up there, you know, the Stax Diner and the Bab and everyone, they're all doing fantastically well up there. And they're all so busy all the time.
So busy. You can't get a table anywhere on like a Thursday night if you
Yeah, so it's been great. And we're, you know, this conversation a year ago would have been very different. We were in the middle of like opening. We don't know why we always open restaurants at the end of the year. It's like the stupidest time to open restaurants. But yeah, so it's good. And it's been really good to sort of survive the year and then get rewarded for it by having that. And I guess it's just such a different crowd there. And it's, you know, so it's much more the evenings in Stoke Newington are very relaxed and kind of neighbourhoody, whereas in Soho it's very, you know, it's very bustly, and we there's lots of cocktails flying out and lots of our big sharing plates. We've got a sort of feasting menu there where a whole table can share some big, you know, whole fish or a big pastrami short rib or a shakshuka in the evening, and those things are going down really well there. And you know, it's a really, really lovely atmosphere in the evening. And but yeah, they're both sites are now kind of forming their own identities.
That's really nice. Yeah, I can imagine there must be a lot more kind of, I don't want to call them tourists, but sort of out of town.
They are tourists.
Yeah, tourists, just people
here. It's a remarkably it's different tourist, crowd, yeah, yeah. And I think that's what's taken the time to adjust to, is that there's obviously a huge workforce in Soho. There's a huge number of tourists that are out in Carnaby Street looking for somewhere to eat.
Yeah.
There's pre-theatre, post-theatre.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's people that gravitate towards Kingly Court because it's a food destination. So whereas in Stoke Newington, we've always been able to be very much like, this is what we do, you know, this is what you should have. People are very much more, you know, they're looking for something that they understand, they're looking for something specific. You kind of have to a little bit more be all things to all people. So, you know, a lot more of the people that come to Kingly Court perhaps aren't so fussed about our sourcing and that we spend a lot of time on that, but it's really important to us that we keep it at the front of the messaging, and we still have our board that says where everything comes from, and the staff still know all of that, even if not everyone wants to have a chat with them about it. But it's great, you know, we're trying to make ourselves that neighbourhood restaurant in Soho, so that whether you're a tourist that's coming in, you might come twice, you might come once for breakfast and once for dinner, or if you work there, you might come in once a week for lunch, or if you're just someone that comes to the theatre every 6 months, then maybe you'll come in and have your pre-theatre dinner with us.
What kind of menu adjustments have you made for the Soho one?
So there's a lot more stuff in Soho that you can have just for yourself.
Okay.
And there's some things
less that, sharing.
Yeah, so the sharing's still there, but it's more, the sharing's kind of features more as a set menu there,
okay,
where you kind of, it's a fixed price per head for the table, and you know you're kind of guaranteed to get enough food. I think that's what people perhaps worry a bit with sharing plates. Well, it's funny. I think maybe
like you always have loads of food when you're sharing.
Yeah, I think I think when we opened with a small plates menu in the same way we did in Stoke Newington, so it's meat, fish, veg, and plates range from like, you know, £7 to £15 or something like that. And I guess, I don't know, maybe people will maybe because of the crowd in Kingly Court, I don't know, maybe more, they wanted to have, you know, to understand what they were having more and to kind of have their own thing and share sides. So it's kind of evolved in that way, really. So, and we have some of our signature sandwiches from the daytime on in the evening as well. So if you want something a bit less formal, like a Reuben and a side of fries, then you can do that. But then all the sharing options are there. And so all of our mezze stuff, all of our breads and dips is there. And hopefully, you know, the staff are there to guide people through the menu. But it does, you know, it does seem like there's some people that want to kind of, you know, they don't want to have a conversation. They want to sit there and do that. But, you know, it's far more diverse there. That's it. You've got to be able to cater for a much wider range of people. And that includes people that don't want to have a conversation about what they're having. They want to choose something and do that. So that's, you know, that's fine too.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
It's interesting.
So, how did you fund the first site?
Crowdfunding.
Oh, I didn't realise that. I thought it was just the second one.
Yeah, no. So we've done it twice.
So how come you decided to go down the crowdfunding route?
We just didn't really feel like we had any other options. We were talking to a few people, a few sort of wealthy individuals about site one, and it was just, we couldn't get people to sort of buy into our story and our pop-ups and our things at a good enough valuation. So we were fine, you know, we were talking to people about giving away half the business for just enough money to raise to do site one. And at the time, crowdfunding was quite new. There'd only been a few restaurants on it, like the Clove Club had done their raise on it. And it just ticked all the boxes for us. We were able to raise at a sensible valuation, which meant that, you know, the people that were doing all the work and started the business didn't have to give it all away.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fantastic PR. You know, we made a video and that got out to loads of people. And off the back of it, we got, I think, 250 investors from that first round, you know, who all had various, you know, they might have just had their name written on the wall, or they might have a discount, or, you know, there was some sort of reward in there. And also they were, you know, they were then on their own private mailing list, and they got updates about, you know, it's just, you're building your audience there, I guess. And so, you know, Crowdcube's not the cheapest way to raise money. It's, you know, they take a commission, but it's a very, if you can manage it and you've got the time to manage it, it's a very good way of, you know, raising money and promoting your business, and often raising at a good valuation, which was important to us.
The PR thing's come up before, hasn't it? That's why another brand went down that route, because it's such great.
Yeah,
so
I mean, it's got its downsides as well, because for our second site, you know, first time we're sort of saying, you know, oh, we did these pop-ups and here's some pictures of us cooking eggs and this is a thing. And then the second one, you've already got a business and you basically have to put that business out there and say, look, this is how we've performed financially.
Yeah.
You know, we've had, it's been a tough first 2 years, we're getting there.
Yeah.
Can you give us some more money? And then you're kind of, you know, then you're doing this really public thing where you're like, look at this, you know, and then and people are asking, so, you know, the nice people send you a private message and ask you a question, the horrible people put something really like aggressive on the forum on Crowdcube and ask you loads of really difficult questions, and you have to spend days responding. So it's like, it's a very intense, involved process. And there's people that go on the crowdfunding forums just to cause trouble, and, you know,
I bet.
Yeah,
gosh.
Not even willing to invest. And, you know, you've got that thing where you owe it to everyone that's going to give you money to either speak to them on the phone or even meet in person.
Yeah.
So you might go and you might get someone that puts like, you know, 50 grand in without even meeting you. You don't know who they are. And you might get someone who puts 200 quid in and you have to go and have dinner with them or something like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, I hadn't thought about how exposing it is.
Exposing.
You've got,
it's really scary.
Books to have to show, and
yeah.
Anyone can have a go and have a look at them.
Yeah. And that's, and you know that you're, you know, and it's, you know, I would do the same, but, you know, your competitors then know everything about your business as well, and how much money you're taking and what you're, you know, which is good. You know, it means I kind of like it that stuff's out there, because food's quite an open industry anyway. Everyone seems to know everyone.
Yeah.
You know, you walk around with like property people, and oh, that site's taking this much and that site's taking this much. It all feels very weird. You know, you need to know if we're looking at ever doing another site. You need to know what you could make in that site. I think, you know, it has to come back to being a sustainable business that can support itself. Otherwise,
yeah,
you're just in the kitchen every day, you know, and doing that, which is fine, which is, you know, and I love that. But for us, it always had to be a business that supported its staff,
absolutely,
and that, you know, and looked after itself, you know, rather than being a kind of lifestyle business, like a passion project.
For sure. How many team members do you have at this point?
About 60 or 70, something like that. We've got lots of part-time staff, so it kind of skews the numbers. But yeah,
yeah,
like it's about 20 people in Stone Newington, about 50 in Soho.
Amazing. Such a big operation.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And people are always like, oh, yeah, restaurants are really hard. And they are, but they don't tell you why, you know, why they're hard. And you don't ever think, you sort of start these, you know, you do this because you love cooking, or you love looking after people, you love providing hospitality. No one's ever like, you have to be really good at managing people if you want to do that. You know, because that's 90% of it is managing people. And
did any of you have management experience when you started?
Yeah, I mean, so my IT job that I had, I'd worked there for about 4 years before we started The Good Egg, and that was, I was leading a small team there, but really that was just because, you know, I was just there for long enough to do that. And Oded had done, oh, he's going to kill me, what's that qualification? The business thing.
Oh, MBA.
An MBA. Sorry, Oded. Oded trained as a lawyer and then became a pastry chef and then did an MBA.
Oh, wow.
And was when I met him, he was like a consultant at the bread factory designing brownies or something like that for Gales, which are really good. But yeah, so I guess none of us had like real management experience, but arguably Alex is the best manager, and he was a musician before that. He's very good at seeing things from other people's point of view, and I think that's a really important skill. So, you know, we just learn off each other, and we work with a really great management training company called Watershed, who do a lot of work with places like Deschutes and Hawkesmoor and stuff like that. It's kind of a more holistic approach to management and coaching, things like that. And we send our managers and our head chefs on that to make sure, you know, just to kind of make sure it's not like about telling people how to do things. It's so that they're aware of, you know, maybe you should think about what you're going to say to someone before you sit down and tell them that they've done something wrong or that sort of thing. So it's so counterintuitive to not give someone that feedback, whether it's positive or negative. And that's the other thing as well. I'm not very good at praising people when they have done, not like in a sort of horrible way, but I just find, you know, I've got so many great staff that are so dedicated and work really hard. Kind of good at saying, oh, thanks for, you know, working long hours, but, you know, you need to give people feedback when they've done something well as well.
What would be a typical week for you, if you have a typical week?
I don't really. It's something I need to work on a bit more, getting a bit more of a routine. But so Monday's usually like when both sites and all the restaurants do their admin from the week before, so all their sales and just payroll and things like that. So I'm usually in one or both of the sites then, and we sometimes have Stoke Newington's closed on Monday evening, so we've been doing events there. So we've had the Counter Talk Women in Food events there once a month, or there's some sort of maintenance going on. So Monday's usually like the most horrible day of the week because it tends to be like first thing to last thing. But yeah, so and then the rest of the week just depends on, it depends on what's going on. If that, you know, so meetings with, you know, we've got a team in house that does marketing. Like I say, Juliet looks after all the food. So depending on what's going on, we might have planning meetings. So try and condense those to like one day potentially, and then I might do a shift or two in the sites depending on what's needed on the kitchen or on the floor, although not so much anymore. And then yeah, just day to day, running, making sure people get paid on time, making sure that the sites are performing well, meeting, you know, having meetings with different people. And yeah, it doesn't sound like I do very much actually.
No, it's very like busy. You do everything.
It's very full on. And then we do, yeah, we have a storage, we have like the stuff that sometimes needs to go between the two sites, which I always ends up always sort of falling on my thing, my lap. So yeah, that's kind of.
And are you working 5 days a week or six?
Not, I mean, yeah, anything from 5 to 7. But yeah, I'm getting better at having one day off a week. But I usually end up working one day of the weekend because it's nice to have, like, it's quiet. And I can just work at home and catch up on stuff from the week.
Yeah, without things adding to your inbox.
And the sites are both so busy at the weekend. It's kind of, if I'm not needed in the kitchen or on the floor, it's good to just be out. I mean, that's what December's just been like. It's busy every day at the moment. But normally you can, like, work. I can work in Soho during the day and, like, you know, have my laptop out, but at this time of year it just feels like you're in the way. So yeah, but yeah, so tend to work like 6 days a week. You know, there's always something. There's always like tastings or events coming up or meetings to have with people or, you know, different things. It's a very varied, not particularly well structured week.
And what kind of strategies do you have for keeping well during the week?
On a good week, I'll do some yoga, running, football on a Saturday, and maybe some like mindfulness and meditation. That's a very like hypothetical situation and very rare that all of those things happen in the same week. But yeah, I try and just trying to keep on, I try to like sit down on a Sunday evening and really like map out the week. So say I don't really ever have much of a routine, but I like to kind of try and lock things in and try and, if we're gonna have loads of meetings, try and have them all on the same day. And then the other kind of like well-being stuff kind of is a bonus if I can find time for that. But yeah, it doesn't happen very often.
But it's good to have things in mind, and then you just do what you can when you can. Yeah. It's better than nothing.
Yeah, I'm not great on like self-discipline. You know, I tend to eat too much and drink too much and not get enough sleep most of the time. So, but I kind of know what, you know, every now and again you have a little reset and come back to those things that you know kind of you need to do to get back on an even keel.
Yeah.
But it's also like a mad time, you know, like we're 3 years into this kind of like project and we're going to do, you know, we want to do more sites in the next year or two. So I'm kind of, you know, I'm ready for more action at the moment. You know, I'm not ready to kind of like sit back and let it just play out at the moment. There's lots more to do.
So are you actively looking for more sites at the moment?
Not actively, no. Okay. But like tentatively. We're looking. Everyone seems to be moving to Margate.
Yeah.
So Alex, who's my business partner and the head chef of Stoke Newington, has moved to Margate. Juliet, who's our group head chef, is moving with her family down to Margate. So there's a possibility we might do something down there Something very small.
But Margate and Hastings seem to be like Hastings is also the places at the moment.
No, no, they're very. But yeah, I don't know. It's very. It's all very tentative, and we're set. We're kind of. I think we want another 6 months of like consolidating everything we've learned over the last year and not doing any new stuff. That's it. But there'll be more. There'll be more to come.
Exciting.
When I've had a rest.
Yeah, maybe not open in December again.
Yeah, that's never happened. Madness.
What would you say you feel is your greatest achievement within this whole journey you've been on?
Oh, that's a really tough one. But I think just getting Stone Newington open, and getting both of the restaurants open, and like we had having them open and profitable. Is a big, you know, it's not easy to have a restaurant, it's not easy to open a restaurant and have it like just opening and having people come in and selling them food and having them go again and have a nice time is one thing, but having it do that and then work as a business is, and that's by no means a sole achievement of mine, but that's probably the thing I'm most proud of, that there's a thing in two locations where people come because they want to go there and then they have a nice time and they leave. Sometimes they say nice things on TripAdvisor and Google. Quite often they say nasty things. But yeah, even though that's kind of everything, I think that's the thing, that when things are really stressful and if it all ended tomorrow, I'd be like, well, actually, it's okay, because that was a big achievement to even like get to that point.
Yeah.
Because you do forget that. You forget like what making something that big is, and that's why I try and remember that as often as I can.
Yeah, that's really nice, and you're right, sometimes you do need that, just to have something in mind, so that when you're so immersed in everything, you can just return to that.
Yeah, and it's really easy to get focused on how crap everything is, and like, you know, you get a bad review, and you go, I go into the sites, and you know, you have, you know, you see everything when you're the owner, when you've, you know, when, and you go in there, and there's something not in the right place, and the chef sent out the food to the wrong table, you know, and you're just like, this is awful, everything is terrible, you know, what are we doing? We don't know what we're doing. And then you're like, actually, you know, these are all little tiny little problems that can all be solved in a bigger way. And that's, you know, the fact that there's anyone even standing in here is a miracle. So let's just focus on that.
So if people want to visit, we've already mentioned there's a restaurant in Stoke Newington and there's a restaurant in Soho. Where can people find you online?
So they can find us online at thegoodegg.co.
Mm-hmm.
Which is confusing because everyone thinks it should be .com or .co.uk. But yeah, hopefully if you trust Google, put the good egg in, will come up.
Comes up straight away.
Yeah. So there's our website. You can book online. You can order a babka and some merchandise to take home now as well. We've got hats and keep cups and stuff. But you can order a babka for Christmas. And then Instagram and Twitter, we're at @thegoodegg_. And I think Facebook, we're at /thegoodeggco or something like that. But it's all, yeah, it all should be very...
You'll find it.
Yeah. Amazing. Or just come and say hi.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you
for having me. That was really, really fun.
Thanks so much for listening. You can find us on Instagram at What's Cooking Podcast, on Twitter at What's Cooking Pod, or drop us an email at thewhatscookingpodcast@gmail.com.
If you liked this episode, please do go and leave us 5 stars on iTunes, and bye!